From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This year, State of Belief is celebrating 15 years of weekly broadcast from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. So much of that work has only been possible thanks to the generous support of you, our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, please let me say a very sincere thank you. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Our program airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it. Do it today. We've got a very full show for you indeed.
Catholic priests in Germany are set to bless same-sex couples in defiance of Pope Francis.
The story made headlines around the globe, even as the Vatican seems to be cracking down on Catholic clergy affirming LGBTQI+ persons and their relationships. The Catholic Church in Germany is stepping up a bold defiance, inspiring celebration for many and worry for quite a few. That's quite a different dynamic than the church in America has with queer people of faith. And we'll get a first-person look at the situation in Germany with Father Holger Almenroder, a Catholic priest and LGBTQI+ activist in Essen, Germany.
Come this June, Catholic bishops will decide on whether to develop a document that would demand President Biden and other pro-abortion politicians not receive communion.
You'll doubtless remember some priests in the United States loudly proclaiming that no Catholic could vote for a Democrat. Since the election, renewed agitation to refuse the sacraments to Catholic elected leaders, including President Joe Biden, who are not submissive enough to the Vatican, has been making headlines. On this week's show, we'll get an expert take on this troubling dynamic with theologian Massimo Fagioli, author of the book Joe Biden and Catholicism in the United States. But first,
in a world of skeptics, Reverend Dr. Megan Rohr isn't too bothered by them.
It's not a problem at all that there are folk who when they look at me and how God is using me in this world, go, huh.
Just 1 week ago, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America took a step that no other denomination in this country has yet taken. It elected an openly transgender bishop. The Reverend Dr. Megan Rohrer will lead the Sierra Pacific Synod. As outrageous attacks on trans lives and identities, physical, legislative, and religious, grow in number and viciousness, it is a rare blessing to be able to celebrate such a milestone. And it is a joy and an honor to be able to welcome Bishop-elect Rohrer to State of Belief Radio. Dr. Rohrer, congratulations, and thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
You've been at the forefront of change and growth in your denomination before. In 2006, you were the first openly trans person ordained by the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. Did you set out to be a revolutionary, or did it just happen?
I think it's a little bit like when Jesus noticed that there were men sowing in their boats during a time when sowing was only women's work. I think God picks mysterious people sometimes, and it really feels like the Holy Spirit's up to something and I'm just along for the ride. And so it's a joy to see how far the church has come, because I think it's a great metaphor for what our lives can be and how our lives can change and what our journey of faith can be like, where we can change our minds and that's okay.
Dr. Rohrer, what kinds of things would you hear from trans people of faith when they saw you in the role of a pastor and a role model?
I think for a lot of trans people, we spend a lot of our lives trying to defend we have a lot of energy that comes towards us of people who can only imagine that we are sinful. And I think my presence, my clerical collar, my robes and my sermons inspire people to imagine trans people in a better light as faithful people rather than as people who are up to something. And I think there probably isn't a week that passes that I don't get messages from trans people who feel like the fact that I exist in the faithful role that I do means that they can choose to stay alive for another week and another month. Just this last week, I received requests for prayers from the siblings of a trans person while they were sitting in the hallway of an ER waiting for a room to open up because their sibling had tried to take their own life. And so I'm here to preach the gospel. I'm here to try to point to Jesus and get out of the way. But I think there's a lot of people who need to see someone like me so that they can know that life is possible and that love is possible and that God might be up to something with them, even if they don't understand their own purpose yet.
My own pastoral ministry has been marked by a lifetime of learning and expanding my understanding of ways to be, to love, and to include. But lived experience adds a layer of empathy and insight that no amount of learning can quite provide. For you, how has the call to ministry been intertwined with your evolving understanding of your own identity?
I began kind of in seminary this journey of being with the poor and homeless. I spent the first 12 years of my ministry eating with folk on Polk Street in San Francisco and loving people regardless of their social economic status. And I'll confess there were moments when I thought it was too much, when the church was debating things that made me think, heck, I could maybe do a different job. And throughout that whole time, there were homeless individuals who I would share this with, my struggles, and they go, okay, whatever, Pastor. And so that's kind of always been what has kept me going, is that the people that I'm doing ministry work with, the people who I'm eating with and praying with, have always lifted me up, particularly in those times when it's been a really hard struggle. And I'm really grateful for that. And this election, I think, is yes, I'm a pastor who's worked really hard. Yes, I'm a pastor who can do leadership skills. We're going to get some really important things done in the Sierra Pacific Synod. But it's a testament of all the people who voted for their faith in me. And for that, I think that buoys me up way more than any sort of sense that this was what my journey was supposed to be. And so I trust their faith in me just as I trust Jesus's faith in me helping me be saved in the world.
Dr. Rohrer, authenticity is such a cornerstone for a living faith. I wish you'd speak to that idea and to the harm of pursuing certainty out of fear of the unknown and the unapproved.
Yeah, the policies that put hurdles before my own ministry in the ELCA were born out of fear that sprang up out of the AIDS epidemic in our country around that same time period. And so I think there were people who were looking for clear paths forward that would maybe help them stay safer in an uncertain time. And I'm really proud of what we have done, because we're trying as Lutherans, I think, to come out of this current pandemic, this current epidemic, with the same hope and faith that Luther had in the midst of the Black Plague, to say that we're going to try to do the best that we can to open the gospel to others. And I really think part of what resonates with people is that if I can admit some of the ways my skin is different and be honest about my journey, then it gives other people permission to be honest about their journey. And like Christ had scars on the cross, and Adam had scars, and Abraham had scars, that we all have scars, but not all of us talk about them on our day-to-day faith journey. And so I do think there is a part of that being willing to live with integrity, to be out when it's safe, and to walk the life of that God is calling us to. For some in our area, here in California and Nevada, it's harder to be authentic and say the name of Jesus out loud than it is to talk about being transgender. And so that authenticity I encourage both in our evangelism and in our own kind of personal identifying.
Dr. Orr, did you ever think that you would be a bishop?
Never in a million years. Although I said that to my grandmother, and I was, you know how like with your own family, you kind of complain about the parts of the job that other people don't think about. Like there were lots of parts of the job I thought would be wonderful, but I complained to my grandmother once, like, but I'm going to have to get all new uniform. Like, I'm going to have to get new shoes. I'm going to have to get like new robes. And she wrote me a check for all of the payments that a bishop would need. And she said, I don't know that I'm going to see it in my lifetime, but I believe you're going to be a bishop. So go buy those robes. And it was one of those moments where you just got to like start walking the walk. And if your grandma writes you a check, you go start buying the robes. And so it really gave me a good kind of shove in the right direction to believe in myself as much as everyone else believed in me.
Mm. So a young trans person comes to you and says, my church doesn't want me. My church says I don't exist. What do you tell that young person?
Well, I think it starts with God loves you, and there's nothing you can do to screw it up on accident or on purpose. God doesn't decide who to love based on a vote of the majority or based on the whim of culture. It also is rooting people in this idea that there's so much scripture that can support you through those times. Like Psalm 30 verse 5 is one of my favorites. God's anger lasts a moment. God's love lasts forever. This idea, maybe that's true. If God is upset with trans people, thank goodness God has so much more love and compassion for us than that kind of one speck of a moment. Or, you know, nothing, neither death nor life, nor principalities, nor things present can ever separate us from the love of God. But then I think also there is this choice that sometimes folk have to make when the communities they love aren't sure if they can love them back. And so if you feel like you have the days where you can walk through some of that difficulty, know that sticking it out means that the next generation of people will have a path they can walk down that you had to wade whack through the wilderness. If you can't stick it out and you need people to nurture your faith, come join us in prayer and in our pews and in our public life. The Lutheran Church would love to have you.
Hmm. So what did you feel like when you heard you were going to become a bishop?
It was a lot of shock. The other person who was in kind of the final round of the election is a dear mentor of mine. The Reverend Jeff Johnson was one of the first out gay pastors to kind of put themselves in the weed whacking business of making paths for people, and was a part of a group of people that created the candidacy process that I got ordained through. His signature is on my ordination certificate. And so he had always been like a bishop for me throughout my life. And so I just assumed that, of course, this was the day for him to kind of be elected. And then I also had a moment where, you know, having seen everything that happened with Bishop Gene Robinson, I had a security thought of like, wow, my life is going to change and my family's life is going to change. And we're going to do a thing that's hard, but we're going to do it anyway. And then I had kind of this moment of joy that I think all of the hard work that I had done, I don't, sometimes queer pastors kind of have to be superheroes, work harder and longer and bigger in hopes that people will notice that God's up to something. And so it felt like it was a celebration and an acknowledgement that all that hard work could be recognized at a different level of leadership, and also could be something that, you know, trans folk all over who are wondering if they're faithful could now know that someone who's going to speak compassion and love can also talk about trans issues, not just those who are the angriest getting the biggest pulpits in our country.
Hmm. What has been the Lutheran response?
Overwhelming love and support. I would say that since the time I was elected, I think it was 5 days ago, I have felt more collegiality with other bishops than maybe in my whole career of people just wanting to offer love and support. The ELCA has been really helpful for me in letting me know that they're with me and they're supporting me. And I think part of that is because we did a bunch of work before this that maybe is less impressive for kind of popular culture, but we studied for several years and released a document on how to reduce gender violence that very clearly stated that trans people are a part of that journey and folk we need to publicly advocate for. And so I think because our church had done the work, it was a lot easier for folk to publicly and openly and quickly support and accept me.
Mm. Bishop, your ministry has included a lot of work with the hungry and homeless. Things have gotten so much worse for these populations during the deadly pandemic. How would you like to see our governments and our faith communities change their priorities to help those who are most in need?
Yeah, a lot of this comes out of Martin Luther's work. Like, he believed that even though there were holidays in our Christian tradition that required for us to give to the poor, that we shouldn't be people who needed the poor in order to live out our faith. And so he was very strong at advocating that civil governments do everything they can to care for as many people as possible. My hope is that we can invest in feeding people, in making sure people of all different skin tones get equitable education and opportunities, that is considered a part of the infrastructure that we want to, you know, make sure is moving forward. And I also think that as faith leaders, we can feed people meals all day long, and we'll do that because that's a part of our faith. But what I learned every time I sat and ate with the homeless is they're hungry at the next meal too. And so I think faithful people are great at filling in some of the missing rungs on the ladder out of homelessness, but we really need systems that support people and actually give them places where they can live and be and have the full benefits of healthcare. And so I'm going to work to encourage our congregations to get much closer to being compliant to the ADA code, the American Disabilities Act, mm-hmm. so that we can have spaces that can support housing some of the efforts to care for folk who can live in a building rather than outside. And my hope is that we can make sure that as we start recovering from this pandemic, that there should be no child who is going hungry. And I mean that in the Christian sense of children of God.
As you now look ahead at the work that the bishop needs to do, what do you expect that you'll need to focus on the most as you begin your work leading the Sierra Pacific Synod?
Well, the good news is that the number one thing that I was talking about with people was to do evangelism. And I think I've done every major media outlet in the last 4 days that you possibly could and said the word Jesus and Lutheran and join us as much as I possibly could. And so I think a large part of the work that we really have to do that's maybe untangling the knots of of the systems of oppression in our church involve trying to remove as many hurdles as we can from particularly from the anti-racist work that we have ahead of us. I know that I only get to the position where I get elected as bishop because of all of the faithful communities that did that work for me and helped kind of support me on my journey. And so I think we have to kind of go all in caring for our BIPOC brothers and sisters and making sure that our church is a place that is living to support the full creation of what God is up to in this world.
You know, we seem to be at such a profound crossroads in this country, with some of us recognizing that the rainbow diversity among us is one of God's greatest gifts to humanity, while others fight to erase the very notion that it exists. As you accept this new position, what do you think will help get us moving in the right direction on this?
You know, I think we, in our church, we sometimes have had a hard time knowing what to do with prophets. And maybe the more difficult struggles in my own pastoral journey is the moments where I had some prophet work to do were the times that maybe it was the hardest for people to know what would happen next in my journey. And so I wish that there was a way that we could move forward, because one of the things that I love about the Bible in particular is the people who will spend their whole life proclaiming the exact opposite of me know that God loved them from the exact same book that tells me that God loves me. That's what kind of points to the fact that it must be a faithful book. And so I think our churches should try to live that way the best we can as well. So when there are people who are angry and in the streets and are riling up justice like prophets, we need to find a way to name that they are a part of the same church work as those who are going to have a book club and are going to reasonably figure out what to do next, and who are going to find more subtle ways to change from the inside. And it's not always going to be easy to sit together, just as, you know, the history of civil rights work in the United States has taught us. Prophets don't always want to sit with the people who are doing change from the inside, but I think we can do it anyway. And maybe part of that authenticity we were talking about earlier is that we just acknowledge when it's hard. We acknowledge when we screwed it up. We say sorry when we were on the wrong side of justice. And we just make sure we keep walking together forward.
Mm, that's great. What role does every faith community have in affirming and protecting the lives and dignity of the most marginalized people in our lives?
One of the things that I kind of know from the interfaith work that I've done and the chaplaincy work, particularly that I've done during the midst of this pandemic, is that faithful communities exist to lift up and show support and to be a sign of compassion and to point to this idea that there is either a supreme being that is bigger than us or a way of breathing that can help us get in touch with kind of the ways that we don't have to suffer on purpose and that we can kind of untangle ourselves from things that are hard. And so I think of the trans experience maybe as best described as a pilgrimage, right? All of us who have been through puberty know that we might have started puberty with lots of great ideas about what our body is going to be like at the end of it. Many of us discover puberty has its own choice and directions that it's going to lead us in. And so the trans journey, it comes with a lot of things I'm hoping for inside of myself. But ultimately, it's a journey I've got to walk through and figure out where I'm going to get on the other side of it. And for many of us, it's a journey that keeps continuing as we discover new things about ourselves as we age and as we wrinkle and as we love other people, as we parent, and as we interact with the world. And so faith communities, particularly those who understand that human beings go on a journey and that we always kind of seek to be better, or we seek to look towards what is going to make the world wholer and closer to something that is healing, have the ability to encourage trans people and all people to find ways that they can kind of go through this pilgrimage, learn to love themselves, learn to love their neighbors, and the best they can to treat others as they would like to be treated. And so I think it's really about just take the charisms of your faith that are the best, offer them to trans folk, and it will help us on the journeys that we're on.
Nobody wants to be singled out for just one part of their identity, but the fact is, trans folk in this country have never before heard from a bishop who lives their reality openly every single day. Could you speak briefly to them in whatever way you are moved to do so, with the recognition that we all live at the intersection of diverse and overlapping identities?
Yeah. To my trans siblings, what I would say is that I am one of many in a large struggle of people who seek to just do the jobs they're called to, whether it's trans folk who are serving in the military or want to be teachers or doctors or approved to elected positions by the House of Representatives, right? We are people who might have choices about how we want to be seen on the outside or how we want to live in our own skin. But more than that, we are people that are hoping to just do good work in the world. Hmm. And like any group of people, there's at least one or two people who might be jerks in any job, right? And so my greatest wish for our trans community is that our private parts get to be private, right? That our body choices get to be our own, that folk speak to us and name us with love, and that when we are wanting to live and do work in the world, that we're afforded all of the opportunities of anyone else who can live and work in the world. Because thankfully, most job resumes don't require you to disclose your private parts. Mm-hmm. And so the hope is that that will continue in the future and be something that all trans people get to experience as well.
Right, Reverend Dr. Megan Rohrer is a pastor, an activist, and an author whose books include Transgender Children of God, Queerly Lutheran, and The Chaplain's Heart. Dr. Rohrer has just been elected Bishop of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, Sierra Pacific Synod, the first openly trans person to be elevated to this position by a major denomination in this country. Dr. Rohrer, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much.
We're just getting started with this week's show. Up next, here it comes again, the threat of denying sacraments to Catholic elected leaders who don't want Rome telling them how to govern. What happens when one of these leaders is the President of the United States? And later, how a growing number of Catholic bishops and pastors in Germany are saying enough to the exclusion of LGBTQI+ persons and their families from the life of the church. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. I'm Welton Gaddy. It's a historical snapshot that we keep coming back to again and again. Running for the White House in 1960, Catholic John F. Kennedy declared that, and I'm quoting him, "I do not speak for my church on public matters, and my church does not speak for me." But that was then. In recent years, some American Catholic bishops obsessed with culture war issues have grown increasingly bold in demanding elected officials who, in JFK's immortal words, happen also to be Catholic, including House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senator John Kerry, toe the line on abortion or be publicly denied the sacraments. And now President Joe Biden's in the crosshairs, and we're looking now to see what's going to happen. For expert analysis of this volatile situation, we turn to Professor Massimo Fagioli, author of the book Joe Biden and Catholicism in the United States. Massimo, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
This attempt by part of the Catholic hierarchy in this country to exercise dominance of Catholic politicians is really nothing new. When did it originate?
It's nothing new. It's old. But I should also add that it's not just part of the Catholic hierarchy. It's also part of the Catholic Church. I mean, the people in the pews that have grown in this belief that the laws of the church should automatically become law of the nation, the law of the land. And so it has always been a very complicated relationship between the Catholic faith and politics. It has become more complicated in these last roughly 50 years because of the so-called biopolitics. It begins with contraception, and then abortion in the 70s, and then it becomes euthanasia, and then gender issues, LGBTQ. So these compact of new issues on which the state authorities need to legislate and to regulate has put to the fore very sensitive issues that are very close to the Catholic idea of the human person and of society everywhere in the world. In this country, it is particular because we have a two-party system, and this two-party system has created basically a two-party church. Yeah. And so this is extremely complicated in this country especially.
You know, I remember seeing a video of a Catholic priest in full vestments preaching that, and this was the quote, no Catholic can vote for a Democrat. How prevalent do you think this attitude has become?
It is hard to say. So we know that the Catholic vote in this country is a swing vote. And so it is very close to be 50% for Democrats, 50% for Republican Party when it's about the election of the president. It is very different if you poll white Catholics that are in majority Republican, or if you poll non-white Catholics that are in an overwhelming majority for the Democrats. Mm-hmm. And so it has come back lately because of Joe Biden's Catholicism that has given a certain kind of ideological Catholic culture and fuel to step up their battle on the so-called culture wars. And so it is not prevalent, but certainly it is representative of a particular kind of Catholic culture. It's not an exception. It is an integral part of what Catholicism has become in this country.
What was the demand circulating this week regarding the sacraments and leaders like Pelosi and Biden?
So it has come back in this last week because we know that there has been an extraordinary step made by the Vatican. They sent a letter to the Bishop Conference in this country, basically telling them, stop talking about this in terms of a threat of denying communion to pro-choice Catholic politicians, because this is not the way to go about that issue. There should be a communal consensus deliberation. But actually, this is about Joe Biden. This is something that begins already last year during the campaign, even before he was elected, because there's a history, especially we saw that in 2004 when John Kerry was a candidate. Yeah. A few Catholic bishops openly said that they would expect John Kerry, being a pro-choice politician, not to show up for communion. Now, it's important to know that this is really part of the intention of a small group of Catholic bishops in this country, and it has never been the official position of the Vatican and of the popes, not even Pope Benedict, to adopt such a cultural war use of communion. And so here you have that a small group of very ideological Catholic bishops in this country, they are in control of the National Bishop Conference. And this is at odds, not just with Joe Biden and many Catholics in this country, but also at odds with the Vatican, actually.
Hmm. So do you see this as something that will be so profound that it will come to disapproval of Biden?
I don't think so. So what happens in this country is that the political cultures are so entrenched that it's very hard that something that someone on the other side does changes your mind. Mm. And so this is true also for Catholics. I mean, certainly it's extraordinary that the Vatican sends a letter to the U.S. bishops basically defending the right of a Catholic president to receive communion, even though this Catholic president is pro-choice. Hmm. And so I don't think this debate will stop here. It will continue. Yeah. But it has become much more difficult for the leadership of the U.S. Bishop Conference to go forward with a threat. It's hard to imagine how they can defy the Vatican on this after there has been, I mean, from the highest authority of the Vatican on theological issues, I don't know how they can go forward with that.
Asimov, I'd like to focus on some things in your book that really stood out for me. Among the six key issues for American Catholicism in the public square that you emphasize is the relationship between the church and our democracy. At this moment, do you see the Catholic Church, as well as other denominations, helping or further eroding the troubled foundations of our democracy?
This is very important because historically, American Catholicism begins its history in this country as a small minority of immigrants, I mean, poor immigrants, but especially in the 20th century, becomes accepted also because Catholicism accepts democracy, especially after World War II and the Cold War. And so what's happening right now, so what we saw with this, I mean, split within U.S. Catholicism, with one part embracing Donald Trump and those conspiracy theories and so on, it is historically extraordinary because it's a contradiction of this long march of U.S. Catholics proving themselves of being good Americans in the sense of being good citizens. They respect the democracy. And so I believe that this is a critical moment because it is unimaginable for a church as big as the Catholic Church in this country to become one of the forces undermining our democracy. Hmm. Actually, this is something that's happening in other countries in different forms, because Catholics have contributed to the rise and the election of some authoritarian leaders in Brazil, in the Philippines, in Hungary, in Poland. So it's not just America. But again, in the United States, that has an extremely high symbolical value because Americans accepted Catholics in the mainstream, also because Catholics had no doubts that it was much better to be in favor of free and fair elections than of an authoritarian regime. And that came back into doubt in these last 4 years under Donald Trump, actually.
I found your chapter, The Catholic Crisis of Globalization, Religion, and Politics in America, to be extremely interesting. Talk about the interplay of ever-growing secularity and multiple Catholic crises.
This is integral part of what has happened in these last few years. What we see in this country is not just a polarization between Democrats and Republicans within Catholicism, but there's also been very visible a growing rift between conservative American Catholics and the Vatican, which is unusual, unprecedented. So why is this happening? Well, because Pope Francis is a Jesuit from Latin America. And this has created anxiety in those conservative Catholics in this country that are afraid not just that it's not clear what's going to be the role of the United States in the global world, the rise of China and of India and so on, but there's also anxiety about what kind of future this Catholic Church in this country has. And so here there's a conflation of uncertainties on the global role of this nation and anxieties on what's going to be the role of Catholicism in this country and of American Catholicism in the global world. Because Pope Francis has made clear that for him, Catholicism is essentially global. And so it doesn't depend on European culture and not even on North American culture. So this is a very critical juncture because all this wave of criticism against Pope Francis is revealing of deep-seated fears and uncertainties that came out during the presidency of Donald Trump. And then Joe Biden can rebalance some of that, but it's a very, very difficult job.
Yeah. Earlier, I mentioned the presidential campaign in 1960. To this day, I hold high as a model for any president or presidential candidate JFK's promise that if he became the president and his faith conflicted with the Constitution, he would resign the office, and he hoped that any conscientious public servant would do the same. Would Joe Biden do that? Would you want every president to say that?
I think Joe Biden would do the same. I'm not sure if he would say the same, but he would do the same. In some sense, I mean, we live in a very different world from what John Kennedy was talking about, both in terms of what kind of church and of relations between church and politics. But that line that John Kennedy drew in the sand is still there.
Yeah.
So there's still a very delicate sense of the balance in this country between what are the boundaries between one personal faith and one political office, especially for Catholicism. It is not that high the expectation when you have an evangelical politician, evangelical president, for example, but for a Catholic is different because there's this ghost of the foreign domination of the Pope. So there are so many assumptions that are historically sedimented. And so here Joe Biden is a very different kind of Catholic from JFK, but that civil dogma that I don't speak for my church and my church doesn't speak for me, it's still there and it's still valid.
It's been a compelling topic for many of us, as President Biden invariably includes the language of faith in general and Christianity more specifically in most of his public pronouncements. This is seen by some as pandering and by others as a mild attempt to win back some of the constituencies captured by the religious right, claiming to be their only option. What do you think about that?
I think Joe Biden learned the lessons from the 2016 election, when the religious vote and the vote of Catholics were not considered important. And so the Biden campaign understood that it was important and there was a strategic, move, outreach to that vote. I think it's very hard to accuse Joe Biden of being cynical about his faith. If there's something that can be said about him, is that he is genuine and that he believes what he says, what he does when it's about his Catholic faith. So that doesn't mean that he's naive, not at all. So, but the way he has talked about his faith, directly or indirectly, as a candidate or in the years before, has always been very careful and very well measured. And I would have never said that it was pandering or cynical. Is it something that Americans see as genuine, as real, as a real part of his life, inseparable from his biography? And that is something that may help him cross some ideological boundaries to reach on the other side of the aisle.
Are political divisions in Catholicism hurting Catholicism?
Oh, yes. It's a mortal threat. It's a mortal threat that has always been there, but I've never seen anything as deep and as verbally violent as we see in this country now. Because, as I said, we have a two-party system that has created a two-party church, but as a European, I'm shocked that this two-party mechanism has really become metaphysical, has penetrated the minds of everyone, and everything has to be sorted as of this party or the other party. And so this is a mortal threat, because if there's one thing that is very important for the Catholic sense of Christianity, is this sense of unity, that we are one, we are united despite, in spite of everything. And this is no longer true in our daily lives. There are parishes that are clearly very progressive, parishes that are clearly very conservative, and not primarily on theological issues, but on political issues, because Christians today or Catholics don't argue on the philosophy of the incarnation or of the Holy Spirit. They fight on social political issues. Yeah. And this has already divided this church.
Dr. Massimo Fagioli teaches historical theology at Villanova University, the author of numerous books on Catholic Church history, leadership, and politics. He most recently authored the book, Joe Biden and Catholicism in the United States. It's not just about Catholics. It's all about religion in America in some ways. Thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you. It's been a great pleasure.
It sure seems like Rome has its hands full these days. Never mind defiant arch-conservatives in the United States. What about those uber-liberals in Germany? When we saw reports in the American press of more than 100 Catholic parishes in Germany were defying the command of the Vatican and openly blessing same-sex couples, we knew we had the home field advantage. After all, our producer grew up Catholic and lives in Germany with his husband, so I knew he'd be able to line up the right guest for this story. And so it is, because on the line with me now is Father Holger Almenroder, pastor of two Catholic parishes in the German state of Hessen. Holger, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you for your invitation.
You don't see many American Catholic churches flying the rainbow flag, never mind blessing same-sex relationships. What makes the Catholic Church in Germany so different?
Oh, that's a very good question. you should know I'm rather often in the United States, and I am befriended with many Catholic priests, and a good number of them is also gay, but they are very discreet with that. Well, it would be a lie to say that is in Germany very different, because many of our pastors, priests are a bit inhibited to go in public with this info. Nevertheless, in the last years, it has something changed, because it is a little bit like a second Stonewall, but for priests, Catholic priests. They are rid of the politics of Rome. Yeah. I think many people, and not only priests, feel patronized, paternalized, whatever. And they're saying, no, we are thinking with our own brains. And what you call doctrine, it's somewhat from an anachronism. And we listen in the understanding of obedience, but we don't follow. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We listen what we are saying, but we have another opinion and we decide to choose another way. And that is what I can discover as long as I am in this movement for about 30 something years. That is now coming up again. Also with the movement of Maria 2.0, where women are saying, no, we are rid of this politics of the Roman Catholic Church. We want not just to be heard, we want to participate, and not just cleaning up the church. We want to be integrated, not only in a side role of the liturgy. We think the biologism that Jesus is a man can't be a theological fundamental reason to say women are expelled.
Would you talk about the hashtag Love Wins movement in German churches and how it came about after the Vatican statement on the blessing of same-sex relationships, please?
I only can tell you that it was an explosion of mushrooms. Nobody expected that. It was on the best ground to grow up. It was so spontaneous that I really can't say where did it happen first. You know, I'm participating in a gay lesbian network, and we are at the moment also in this German synodaler Weg, German synodal way, where lays and bishops are talking about the future in the church. And this synodal way is basically also laid ground in the discontentment of the Catholics about the feeling nothing goes in the future. Everything is something stops. Mm-hmm. It doesn't help the people. Church is basically a senseless thing. We are not talking about the faith. Mm-hmm. No? The interesting thing is that many people are thinking, well, it is not my faith I am rid of. It is the church which doesn't help me, which minimizes me, which discriminates me. Yeah, and I'm not talking about gay people. I'm talking about remarried people. I am talking about people who are, not feeling well when they are, dominated by priest opinions, by bishops' opinions. Mm-hmm. Then, well, for about 60 years, with the Vatican, with the Second Vatican, we are invited to grow up in our faith. And what we make as an experience, look to John Paul II. He is trying to get us what is a Maulkorb, when a dog has to be silent. What is the English word? I don't know. Yeah. When by the office is said, no, we don't talk about this topic, like John Paul did it with women's ordination and so on. Yeah, and the people are really rid of here. Maybe it is a very German, it's not only Germany, also Austria and Switzerland, also Luxembourg. It is rather different in France or in Italy. They don't have this problem. It's probably because we are the country or the state of the Lutheran Reformation. Maybe that it is. Yeah. So that is the ground. It was sufficient.
Is this an interfaith movement? Other churches stand with LGBTQI plus persons of faith in Germany?
Well, the established evangelische Protestant churches, it is not their affair because they are much, much further in this development. They had their struggles in the 70s, maybe early 80s. That is for a long time over. But you certainly can also find conservative groups in the Protestant church, especially the Americans may have to understand that the established churches are the Lutherans and the Reformed, mm-hmm. not the Baptism, the Baptists, yes. for yes. example, or the Methodists that are so-called free churches. Among the free churches, you find very conservative groups who are understanding the text of the Bible one-to-one. Mm-hmm. I didn't learn my theology in this way. Otherwise, I would become crazy in a modern world. I can't interpret it like that. So it is not the same problem for the most Protestants as it is now for the Catholics. So there are certainly at our side, but it's not their problem. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I don't need to ask you to imagine how this expression of support and blessing is impacting your LGBTQI plus parishioners, because you yourself are a gay man. So please talk about these events from both a pastoral and personal perspective, if you would.
Yeah. So on this last Monday, I was asked to bless two lesbian couples, and I did. But I didn't publish it in the papers because these two couples didn't want to be in the medias. Yeah. I can't say it was incidentally, it was focused on this day. But what I saw, and I served them. So I tried to form the blessing for these couples, and I hope it works. Mm-hmm. But responsible for the blessing, they are, not me. But at the end, I can say I didn't feel well with this demonstrative act, because for me, it is a very, let's say, sensible pastoral topic. And here I felt, as I said, not very well to use it. I don't say misuse it, to use it as a mass something. I'm living in a little town, not in the center of Frankfurt. In Frankfurt, you could have had, I think, many dozens, maybe hundreds couples being blessed here in Seligenstadt. With around 20,000 population, that's a bit, a smaller something.
Mm. Yeah. Now, this is something that a lot of Americans simply won't understand. The issue of church-driven homophobia seems to be almost unknown in the Catholic Church in Germany, as I understand it. How were you able to openly follow your vocation there?
Oh, it was that was a real struggle. I basically studied in the diocese and for the diocese of Cologne, archdiocese, and I was kicked off because I was suspicious to be a homosexual. And I said, I'm not suspicious, I am. And that was it. Yeah, it was linked with a rather new in this time statements of Pope John Paul II, who said, no, it's not possible to ordain gay men. There was a little bit like a persecution of gay people in the seminary. And, well, I was asked and I said, sorry, I will not easily answer. But after that, I was dismissed and I applied. Also in America, by the way. But the former chancellor of the Archdiocese of Cologne told me, oh, don't do it. America is too conservative for you. Mm-hmm. And so I applied also in Switzerland and also in the Diocese of at the Diocese of Mainz. And the late Archbishop of Mainz, Lehmann, he said, oh, you know, your reputation of Cologne is so bad, we want to realize if you are really so bad. And so they checked, and at the end they said, we are quite glad that we see you working as an apparently honest gay man, and we can accept that. That is also a challenge to bring in your witness, your idea who you are, to help also people who are not so familiar with that or who are suffering. They accepted me. Sometimes I had trouble with them, but at the end they never wanted to kick me, so far at least. Yeah.
You visit the United States enough to know American Catholic priests. What would you say to an American audience, one that includes Catholics and people of many different faiths as well as of no faith, about this celebration of divine diversity?
That's a good question. I have certainly at first to see which thinking about anthropology we are following. I'm always in the twist with some more or less conservative Catholics who are saying, no, but it is by the law of God. That is just sin when you're practicing. It's not sin to be a homosexual, but then you have to be in celibacy. And I'm saying then, really, I don't understand what you are talking about. Yeah, homosexuality you can find in all nature. You can find in nature that fishes are in a certain stadium are changing from male attitude to female attitude and whatever. So don't tell me what is unnatural. Yeah. When you are talking about the natural law of God, you don't know what you are talking about, because you are mingling a spiritual something of a certain faith background with something it's also important for us to understand how we are in a biological way. Mm. Yeah. And we have really to distinguish here properly. Yeah. Mm. Nobody of the gays or lesbians has decided, oh, today I want to be gay. Mm. It is a very long way. And it is not, I don't know anyone who wants to be voluntarily gay. Mm. Yeah. Not one person or lesbian or whatever. So this very, very anachronistic understanding of also of theology to say God has said that. God has defined it this way and this way. I don't accept because it's not true. It can't be true. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here.
Holger Allmann-Roeder is a German Catholic pastor who, along with over 100 other pastors and several bishops, has been openly blessing same-sex couples in that country despite Vatican objections to the practice. What's more, Holger is an activist for LGBTQI plus rights and an openly gay man and a Catholic priest. Holger, this truly has been an eye-opening conversation for an American pastor. I appreciate so much you coming on and talking with us. Continued success in your own ministry, and thank you so very much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you very much. God bless you.
Thank you, and same to you. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your donations help keep us on the air. Please consider making a tax-deductible gift as we celebrate 15 years of continuous broadcasting. Information on how to donate is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Be part of the conversation. Social media helps connect like-minded people in conversation and company. I'd ask you to share State of Belief with just one person this week for whom you think this might be helpful. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. See what he was.